The hour of 10 a.m. having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Subcommittee on Legislative Process Reform. Members, you have in your packet an agenda. I'm just going to go over briefly what we plan to do. There'll be a number of items presented to the Subcommittee. We'll vote on each of those items individually, and I want to remind members of the Subcommittee that you're voting, and other members who are not members of the Subcommittee will not be voting, but certainly are welcome to the discussion. And the motion will be to re-refer each of these items to the full Rules Committee. So that will be the process for today. But again, for our guests, you are welcome to partake in the discussion and to offer advice. And if we don't take it here, the full Rules Committee obviously might. So with that, I think we'll start with, do we have a quorum? Not yet. So we don't have a quorum, so I'm going to go down to number four, discussion of legislative operations training. And Mr. McCormick, is he here? And Mr. McCormick, before you start, since Representative Pinto just walked in, I'm going to move the minutes of 10-24-19. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion approved. And I will move the minutes of 11-12-19. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion approved. So the minutes are approved. Mr. McCormick, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Patrick McCormick. I'm Director of House Research.
And would you go over the members in your packet? There is, and they should be stacked in order, legislative operation trainings. Would you go over that proposal?
Mr. Chair, members, the proposal is a brief restatement and enhancement of the current practices of training under the Chief Clerk Murphy, myself, Bill Marks from House Fiscal. We have conducted a wide variety of training. The amount of training we've done has increased over the last 10 or 15 years. The training ranges from training for CLAs and LAs and CAs, training for the partisan research offices. The chief clerk's office, for example, will do extensive training on how the floor session works and how members can comport themselves on the House floor. The fiscal folks will work on understanding how a budget is prepared and what budget documents look like and what members can expect to see. Our office has conducted new chair training, training for members. We also coordinate training from outside sources. For example, the annual harassment behavior that all members have received is coordinated by our office with an outside contractor providing the training. The NCSL increasingly has a wide range of excellent training services that they can bring to bear. So this proposal would formalize the training and put the chairman of the Committee of Rules and Legislative Administration with the ranking minority member in the business of coordinating and putting together a more coherent schedule and of training, and also will allow a venue for members to ask for specific kinds of training that we don't provide now that we can easily begin to provide or that we can go find. And so this would formalize what is becoming a growing line of business for nonpartisan staff.
Discussion, members. Representative Rumbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wanted to ask Mr. McCormick, has this been an annual event, this training? Because I'm not aware that the opportunity for all members, you know, to be trained in this way occurs at prior to every session.
Mr. McCormick.
My chair members, no, this is happenstance in the sense that we put together training as requested by a new majority. For example, we'll do a whole bunch of training at first, and then that will begin to peter off. And that usually means that when a majority hits the third, fourth, fifth year, we're doing a lot less training because they feel more confident in what they're doing. And then the cycle starts up again with the new majority. For example, new chair training is is something we hit very heavily in the first year of a new majority, as even the people who've chaired in the past are a little bit uncomfortable, but then it withers away. So I think one of the reasons behind this proposal is to prevent that sort of boom-bust cycle and try to create a more scheduled training.
Representative Rumbeck, I'd envision this to be much more of a hands-on experience, where we would have members' experience being a chair. We would have members' experience presenting a bill. We'd have members' experience how you amend a bill in various different ways, so that you would actually understand more the process of what happens. Mm-hmm. And that would be all members, whether you're chairing a committee or not. And I would hope that we would also use, because we have such excellent media capacity, we would have video examples of what is good procedure and what is failed procedure, so that members would be able to envision both and avoid, of course, the failed and concentrate on those that succeed.
Well, Mr. Chair, that sounds fantastic. I would wonder if we wanted to put an additional word in here, include annual training, because, that's been my point, is that we don't seem to have it very regularly at all.
Representative Rumbeck, if the first sentence will design and conduct annual training,
okay, it's there.
Would you
all
like
right.
to make that annual ongoing training or something to that effect?
Sure.
Representative Rumbeck offers the amendment in the first sentence to make that conduct annual, comma, ongoing training. Discussion to the Rumbeck amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Amendments adopted. Further discussion on legislative training. Representative Saul.
Sorry to bring up something like this from a voice not previously heard, but what happens in a practical matter, what happens to be certain that the effect or the desired impact of procedures is actually what people experience?
Representative Saul. If you do this on an ongoing basis, and you do it with the understanding that you're going to have as close as we can replicate real committee hearings, I think you're going to have an experience that they will be able to say, well, I learned something here, instead of walking into a committee and not knowing what's going on at all, or going to the floor sessions and, again, not understanding what's going on. So the hope is that we replicate as close as possible real experiences, and you see them. And then you say, oh, okay, that's what happens. And either you say that's a good incident or it's a bad one.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I, as a freshman, just want to say how helpful I think this would be for myself and my colleagues and on an ongoing basis. Now that I've been here a year, I feel like I've learned a lot, but every hearing almost, I feel like I have more to learn. So I really would value this, and I'm sure many of my colleagues would as well. Thank you.
Representative Robbins, I think you were in Winona and saw at least yes. a bit of the Winona model legislature. Those students go through a preparation that starts in August for an event that happens in November. So the students that you saw there, they all chair a committee. They all present a bill in committee. They all do what's being done here with making committee minutes, and they all have to rotate through. I envision this training to be something like that, so that all of the members would have that experience and they would know exactly what it is that will happen in a real committee. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there was a reference to LAs and CAs going through a training like this. I don't see actually any reference to staff. It just says this training is for members, chairs, and ranking minority members. Is there a comparable provision somewhere for staff?
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, members, we generally do the staff aside from a formal requirement that we would adopt in the Rules Committee. Staff training is a lot more ongoing and a lot more connected to your relationships with the directors of the CAAs and CLAs. For example, we have a new small group of two or three majority staff who are going to come on in January, and we'll do a one-off training for them. We could create one, but it's a lot more routinized and a lot more something that we probably wouldn't need to adopt a new policy for.
Representative Freiberg. Further discussion to what is now the amended proposal. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The very last point, bullet point, talks about ways to manage a legislative career. Just wondering, what was the thought behind that one?
Mr. McCormick.
Madam Chair, members, this document came from working with the chair and the chair's staff. I think it probably, if you look at the bullet point, one of the things that affects your career as a member is the fact that this is a part-time legislature and that you therefore have lives, jobs, duties, responsibilities outside of the legislative environment that constrain, enhance, affect your legislative career. Some of those are formal black letter law requirements that affect what you can and can't do, and others are customs, mores, rules, appearance concerns, and our office, House Research, and to some extent the Chief's Clerk Office will attempt to educate, inform members of how all of these new scary requirements affect their career. We start that right at the very first day with new members orientation, but there is at least some, I think, perception among members that we don't do this on an ongoing basis and that things shift, things change, your requirements that affect you change, and that we should do this. And ways to manage a legislative career are ways to fit your complex life outside of this organization into the, your expectations of you as an elected member. I envision this part as something that the NCSL is specifically very good at. And there's a whole series of kind of training modules that they could bring that would help legislators understand the pressures of a legislative life.
Representative Brumbeck, we've had a huge turnover in staff across both caucuses. We've also had a very large turnover in members. Mm-hmm. This is to clarify what even those relationships are with staff and members so that a staff person knows hopefully that there are limits and the members know that there are limits too and that that should be part of the workplace. And that's eroded a little bit over these turnovers.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, this sounds great. It would be wonderful.
Representative Robin.
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, will there be some sort of a cost associated with this training that we should limit or consider?
Mr. McCormick.
Your nonpartisan staff is free and will train you for free. The NCSL often provides free training and services as part of our annual fee for being a part of the NCSL, so that's got a very low cost. On occasion, we will have to have a outside trainer that with specific unique knowledge like we did in the sexual harassment case. In those cases, leadership either frees up the money for that special training or we help think of ways to get that training for you without a cost.
Representative Robbins, you do bring up a good point. And since we just had the first mini session in 22 years, we're very meticulous in recording how that was put together so that if we have, and I hope we do have another mini session in the next interim, but that we can go back to that and then use that as a model for the future. So that would also help cut costs. Further discussion? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McCormick, I would like to suggest that we also have training for new systems like computer systems and phone systems and media systems that are put into place. And sometimes without our knowledge, except we get a notice saying on Saturday everything's going to be down because we're putting in something new. And then on Monday, everybody that's affected is expected to know what happened to their system or their computer or their ways of receiving and sending technological experiences out into the cloud or the world or the whatever. And there's got to be people that give trainings to everybody, so we would all have somewhat of the same starting out point. Just.
Mr. McCormick.
If you want to make an amendment, I could suggest one. Or we could just take that as something that we would work on.
Just work on it.
Thank you.
Mr. McCormick, that does raise a good point, because even in the new cubes that have now been assembled throughout this building, and they're a big improvement over the previous cubes for legislative assistants and others, you will notice that there seems to be an omission about legal-sized paper being stored in those new cubes. I can understand that we perhaps are moving away from paper, but if we are, then we should have that in the forefront of why we're adopting these new arrangements. That does get to be a little cumbersome. That's not your responsibility, that's ours, but it is an interesting dynamic. Representative Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, I would also like to underline that it was not inconsequential when we moved from a 30-year-old email system that has certain assumptions in how it will function and what it would do into what would be probably considered a state-of-the-art current best thing that Microsoft could put together, which is clearly not what its competitors would have offered or done. So we are all assuming that when we come here, we come with experience and know how to run these things at when somebody turns them on in front of us. I happen to have been trained in a number of different systems at the corporate level before I got here. I had never seen an email system like the one that we were using here and then continued to use for 3 years after I arrived. I don't think I ever really got the concept of how that system did things. And I think that that falls under this kind of a problem, is that there was no training other than maybe some colleague of mine sitting next to me or down the hall who could say, yeah, well, you know, in order to do that or to make that multi-person recipient thing happen in the email, this is how you make this system do it. We do struggle here sometimes with just purely the simple thing that in the rest of the world, the live world out there, would say, when we bring a new system that everybody's going to have to use, you will all know how this is going to run. And right now you're all sitting there with Microsoft and all of its toys and splendor. And none of us have been told what it will do except for random, like this could work or that could work. So I just offer that we do have present that kind of challenge in front of us where people have no clue what the powers are. So then we rely on maybe our staff. Well, hopefully the staff might have known how Microsoft 365 actually runs, because it's not exactly like the old Office that we grew up on. So, sorry, I just wanted to add that as underlying that this is not just a passing in small thing about training. I don't think we do it at all well. That's just an editorial comment of my own opinion.
Now, Representative Sock, you make an excellent point. The fact that the emails that you see under this new email system and the emails that you don't see, that's an experience too. So the way that your email is now cleansed is interesting, because I've had to go back and find some emails that somebody thought I had received, and they weren't in my first email bucket. They were in the other bucket somewhere.
There are two buckets?
There's a lot of buckets. there's a lot of them.
Oh, wow.
So that's an excellent point, too. And I would hope under this we would also have a training on how to use technology when we're in committee, when we should be listening to testimony and not on our devices, whatever the device is. We have gotten numerous complaints from individuals who travel a great distance, and then they come before us, and we seem to be distracted. So our focus should be on the individuals that are testifying. I would hope part of the training would be that, too. Representative Song.
I would only add that your aside to qualify what you were saying is probably not, it's a bit disingenuous from what we did. We passed a state law that when you are holding a cell phone, you are, by definition of law in Minnesota, you are distracted. And yet we sit here, pass and do laws and that sort of thing, and we will stand, oh, yeah, but I was paying attention to what was being said, as well as I was reading somebody else's email to me or communication. I can't agree with you more that that's almost de facto distraction from your job.
Well, I hope other people are listening too, because the complaint that I get more often than not is when we do have individuals who come up and it's 2 hours from and on, and they testify, and yet most of the committee is buried in some device. So we have to retrain how we operate in committee too, and I hope that will be part of this train. Focus on what's there and not what's here. By the way, my phone's turned over, so I can't even see it. So, all right. Any further discussion to this proposal? Seeing none, then all those in favor of referring this to the Full Rules Committee signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion prevails. So, Mr. McCormick, we may need you to come back for number five. Mr. McCormick, do you want to go bullet by bullet down number five, and then we'll take each one individually for discussion and votes?
Mr. Chair, which one is number five?
It's considering of prospective changes to House rules and joint rules, and there are 6 different proposals under that. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the order, so
we'll get it to you.
Let me know which one you'd like me to do. Mr. Chair, members, there are a number of proposed rule changes that are in front of you. The first document has 2 changes, and it's all to the same House rule. And the changes are separate concepts. They appear before you because you should probably see how it fits into the given rule. The given rule is House Rule 6.40. It is the House's rule regarding regulation of conference committees. Conference committees are substantially regulated by joint rule, but there is a second House rule that touches on some components. The first change is in paragraph C. It requires the chair of the House chair of a conference committee who holds the gavel to call a public hearing of the conference committee, and that is with the exception of Sundays and holidays. That mirrors the exception that is in joint rules.
Discussion, members. Representative Rumbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there has been, I think, some back and forth on whether the gavel holding means you do this is for each day that changes, or each meeting, it may rotate. So the rotation thing, something that seems like it should be addressed, certainly, or the practical aspects of that. And, of course, we are only half of the picture, so it comes, down to the Senate. And if they're not going to be looking at this sort of as a joint change, maybe this is, just not going to work.
Representative Rumbach, I think you see that there'll be some proposals in the joint rules, and you're right. We can only operate within our body, but we are hopeful that the Senate would take the wisdom of the House and what's good for the public and would go along with us on this. I think they are half of the problem.
Right.
Representative Rumbach, it has to start somewhere.
Well, yes. And Mr. Chair, the mere calling of a meeting, though, I guess, is, involves a lot of things. And I'm hopeful that maybe the staff that is impacted by, what's going to happen as a result of it, there needs to be some input, perhaps. A lot of issues that really affect them. Can you get a room,
Right. The practical aspect of it is one issue. But the other aspect is a conference committee is empty until you put something in it. So the hope would be that these conference committees would be held and there would be proposals. And the proposals will be or won't be voted in, but at least there's an understanding that there'd be an exchange of proposals, whether you vote on them or not, and that the public would see what those proposals are. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have limited experience with this. This is my first session being on a conference committee, but very much had the experience of the Senate not calling hearings. And I guess it seems to me that that what you were just saying, Mr. Chair, about or what have implied in it to me of having this public space where hopefully then proposals are actually being put forward. I think this makes a lot of sense, and I'm supportive of it. I do want to just make reference to Representative Runbeck's first comment about there being some ambiguity that I've seen in terms of whether the gavel changes every day or every meeting based on weekends and holidays, and that's something that I guess I'll have to think more about. I just remember that being an issue that had come up with us this spring, as the Senate was not calling a meeting like on a Saturday, and we would have called the meeting on a Sunday then, and certainly would have had the gavel if they chose not to call their meeting on the Saturday. And so that may be something. I guess I'll keep an eye on that as opposed to making a proposal for a change at this point. But as far as the idea that when we have conference committees, they should be having a hearing each time, that makes great sense to me. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck, Representative Pinto, the Senate suffers, too, from a large turnover of both members and staff. And the institutional memory of what conference committees should actually do, has faded. So we're bringing it back. Further discussion. So, Mr. McCormick, would you like to go over Part D?
Members, Mr. Chair, Part D requires a written or electronic copy of the report to be placed on the desk of each member of the House or delivered electronically 12 hours before action of the report by the House. This mirrors the joint rules. However, what's not included is the waiver for the end of session. The waiver takes place after the last Wednesday at the end of session, and that means that on the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, the last 5 days, you don't have to have a 12-hour waiting period. If you adopted this rule, that would mean that a conference committee report that came to the House floor always had to sit for 12 hours. And that would mean that the latest a conference committee report could come on the last day of session would be 11:59, which would give you 1 minute to vote for it if we were adjourning at midnight. So practically speaking, it would be the morning of the last day conference committees would have to arrive with their reports. There is a waiver allowing a majority of all members to waive the rule.
Discussion. Representative Rumbay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it would seem to me that the last sentence somewhat negates the whole point of it. So as particularly by allowing the decision to suspend the rules to be made by a majority vote. So, I mean, there's hardly any meaning and, you know, you don't really, it pretty much is going to happen. By whoever is running the chamber and running the show. So was there discussion about whether it'd be a two-thirds vote or something on that order?
Representative Runbeck, you can offer an amendment.
I can offer an amendment. Okay.
Yeah. And if not here, and then the full rules committee. But.
Well, I mean, it's just, Mr. Chair, it does seem that if we really believe this is a good thing to do, and I think we do generally, you don't want to have it be too simple to be overruled. So, I mean, I would suggest that at a minimum we have a 60% vote. About that, that's called a, I don't know what that's called, but.
Well, Representative Runbeck, these don't operate in isolation either. I would hope that if we had deadlines to conference committees, where those conference committees would be concluding their work well in advance of the end of session, so that you wouldn't have them concluding in that last week. You'd have them concluding a week or more before the end of session, that this wouldn't be needed. And that's another part of what we're going to discuss here. There is no one way to fix this thing. There's going to have to be several fixes to do it. And then they'll have to be enforced. But you do make an excellent point.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I think that somebody has suggested that on the committee we don't have a lot of folks that have actually chaired conference committees. So, I mean, this may be a better point to have discussed in the Rules Committee.
All right. And I would hope Representative Runbeck and others would bring it up. But also bringing up the staged way of how these conference committees should conclude their work, mm-hmm. that we shouldn't be concluding them in that last week. They should be concluded before the last week, which pushes everything back you start to take a look at what happens here. Representative Salk, do you have a question?
Our session in January.
Mr. Chair, sometimes I find it interesting as we talk and these kinds of things is that we actually are inferring a solution and or a challenge that isn't present in the discussions. So have we discussed and decided that we are going to do the thing that should come first? In my order of what matters, if we talk about how to shut off the engine, but we haven't talked about whether or not we're going to quit moving, that's the way we end up doing these kinds of things. And it's just, in some ways, it's a little quizzical to me. So why wouldn't we be deciding that there will be a deadline enforced and enforceable to when things must be done that actually exists? Not one that can be pushed aside or stepped aside, but one that the only way around it would be to get to the next session kind of construct, I'm thinking. Really have deadlines that would function both for conference committees and that's it. Now, I know I may be speaking in sacrilege because there are a number of reasons that could be true. But I really don't see why we intend to have rules that would be trying to put a way to put a bow on the effort when we purposefully have left all kinds of doorways to subvert any of those kinds of efforts. So sorry about my, I know that was more of a comment than a question.
No, that's fine. And I would hope that your comment is well taken and that in the process of this, we do exactly what you're saying. This doesn't work unless you do a number of other things to precede it. And that's the point of all of these hearings and what the changes both in the joint rules and the House rules would be. Further discussion on this proposal. Then all those in favor of moving this to the full rules committee signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. McCormick, the next.
Mr. Chair, members, the next change is entitled Keep the 12-hour rule until adjournment of session. This is a proposed amendment of Joint Rule 2.06. If you turn the page to the back side, you'll see the changes. We delete the current language, which sunsets every session, the 12-hour rule after the last Thursday that you can meet in session. And by deleting that provision, it absolutely mandates a 12-hour period before you vote. So there is no waiver in this, unlike the last version, the House-only rule. This absolutely prevents adoption of a Conference Committee report that comes in the last 12 hours of legislative session.
Discussion. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess I'm wondering why the different approach then in the joint rules. Is it because there couldn't be that majority waiver, or is this an alternative path for us to consider whether having a majority waiver is in the rule we just passed to move along, or this is another option? I'm just trying to understand how to think about these two proposals in conjunction with one another.
Mr. McCormick.
I think, Representative Pinto, I think this is just another option. The key difference is that this is in joint rule. When you're trying to create a kind of a hard and fast deadline, you have a choice. You let the body waive that deadline, and therefore the majority can rule, or you make this something that you want followed uniformly. The draft that I was asked to put together makes this a hard and fast rule. So just to carry it through, in the last day of the legislative session, that morning, Conference Committee reports could arrive and as they arose, you know, let's say one came in at 9 a.m. was finished, electronically delivered to all the members. That means at 9 p.m. you could still vote on it, and you'd have 3 hours before mandatory adjournment. But if one came in at 2 p.m. and was posted, You could still waive this rule with a two-thirds majority. And that mandatory waiver is not stated in the rule, but that is under the regular order, you can waive rules with a two-thirds majority. You can also declare an urgency under the Constitution and move the bill forward. So the body isn't absolutely paralyzed by this. There are options. A two-thirds waiver is possible if a Commerce Committee report that was a technical provision that changed one sentence that was universally popular for some reason got hung up with the revisor and came out at 11:52 p.m., people could waive the rules and pass it still. So it's not, in general, as a rule writer, you recommend that you don't want to create a suicide pact that creates an absolute final no way out. The absolute final no way out is adjournment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a couple follow-up questions. So, Mr. McCormick, that waiver, whether the two-thirds or the emergency, that would have to be acted upon separately by each body, I suppose, in that case. Is that correct?
Mr. McCormick.
Representative Pinto, yes.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCormick, and can you just, maybe I missed it or misunderstood, but the two-thirds is separate from suspending the rules, or that is the same? I'm sorry that I just am a little confused.
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, members, both House and Senate rules have a provision allowing the suspension of rules by a two-thirds majority. That's operable in a situation where the bill has already had its legally required first and second reading on separate days, and so the only question is, do we suspend this rule of the 12-hour notice? A two-thirds majority could suspend that rule. You would declare an urgency under the Constitution if the bill hadn't met some constitutional provision like having readings on first, second, and third days. So that would probably be more used in a situation where we actually introduced a bill at 9 p.m. on the last day of session. There's no way you could do a first and second reading on separate days. So you might declare an urgency under the Constitution and give it its first, second, third readings and move to final passage.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Pinto.
So, Mr. McCormick, and so that would also, though, be a two-thirds vote if it was an urgency under the Constitution's mm-hmm. the same threshold.
Yeah, Mr. McCormick,
right. Yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is helpful to understand then that as I'm hearing Mr. McCormick, it sounds like this is just sort of an alternative path. And if we pass this, we'll be sort of giving the Rules Committee a couple of options in terms of a waiver, whether majority waiver or essentially the two-thirds. Mm-hmm. waiver if we go this path, as I'm understanding him. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Pinto, I understand that this would give the leadership something to do with the Senate in negotiations, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. McCormick, just so I'm clear, so the language that we're deleting about the, you know, giving us the permission to not have a 12-hour rule if things occur after essentially the last Thursday of each yearly session. I assume the purpose that language was put in there in the first place was to give us some flexibility the last 4 days of session. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. McCormick.
And Chair members, there's a couple, there's a number of provisions that are designed to give maximum flexibility. For example, the Rules Committee can report at any time, no matter what order of business the floor is on. That allows essentially a kind of a privileged report of the Rules Committee if there's something that has to be taken up quickly. The Rules Committee suspends by resolution every year some of the requirements that give additional notice for posting bills at the end of session. This rule is an automatic suspension of the 12-hour rule for Commerce Committees. It's designed to say that it's actually after the last Thursday. So after the last Thursday, which we can meet in odd-numbered years, so for example, in 2019, after that last Thursday, a Conference Committee report can arrive and be taken up and passed without having to sit for 12 hours. Going back to when this was adopted, I think the pattern was that a large number of conference committees were held with a large number of big, little, important technical issues, and they could come at the floor session fairly fast. And by doing that, you would routinely get into a situation where the House or the Senate might adopt 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 conference committees on the last day, and those would be produced, and you would see them posted by the electronically by the reviser and arrive by email, and then there'd be a scurry to have paper copies come. And quite often the leadership would say, everyone should now have the tax bill or the bonding bill, and we're going to take it up in 30, 45 minutes, and we would churn through those bills. If a legislature adopted this, this would then be a sea change in how we constructed the end days of the legislative session. And as a person who might work on a conference committee, I would then be urging the chairs to get done at a reasonable time, and we would have a hard and fast deadline for the reviser. Those bills would have to be prepared and postable and deliverable before that noon deadline, and in practice before about 10 a.m. on that last day. And the race still could be lost, because you can still put the body in a position where they need a two-thirds vote to take up that bill, that one bill. But in general, if you adopted this rule, the vast majority of conference committee work would probably back up a day, would start to be, instead of finishing on the Sunday night with the actual work and rushing to the reviser, the latest advisable time that I would state would be finish on Saturday, get these bills to the reviser on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, so that on Sunday they could be processed by the reviser and made clean and arrive at the latest by Monday morning. I think those are my comments.
Representative Freiberg.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCormick, you'd said kind of I think your words were the absolute no way out here is adjournment. But, you know, the way it worked this past session was, you know, 3 days after adjournment, we had a special session where we then passed bills. So, I mean, the way this, if this were I guess either because the language we're deleting doesn't reference a special session, I guess there wouldn't be any real change to the rules related to special sessions. I mean, I assume what happened in the special session was we suspended the rules, and then so the 12-hour rule didn't apply in that case. How does this work functionally in a case of a special session?
Mr. McCormick.
Calling of a special session is the governor's unique power, and therefore we really can't do anything about that. This year, for example, the governor agreed with legislative leadership on a process to finish in the 4 days after session, and therefore the governor then consented and called a special session. In a special session, it takes 5 days to pass a bill, because you give first, second, and third reading on 3 days in the first body, and then on that third day, the second body picks a bill up and gives it first reading, and then they have to have second reading and then third reading. So that's a 5-day special session. The way around that is for one or both bodies to declare the urgency under the Constitution and give first, second, and third reading on the same day. That allows a bill to be passed the day it arrives on the floor, and allows the work of the Conference Committee of the special session to be expedited.
Representative Rumbeck, were you? Representative Saul.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if anybody wants to take time. Maybe I should go offline and get the answer to my question. I'd be happy to do that. What I'm finding in this discussion right now is the huge chess game that we play. And essentially, we go to the public and we ask them, would you please vote and declare who is going to be the majority? Let's just cut to that. So when they declare who's going to be the majority, we then set up a bunch of rules on how we are then going to produce forward with those as locked in times and numbers. So it takes a vote of the majority to do whatever we're going to do. We meander our way through to the end, and we just throw that all away because that becomes an annoyance. The fact that we agreed what the majority would be is now an annoyance. So we just screw with the clock and screw with time. And then right now, I find it interesting, and this isn't the first time that I've experienced this. So being I'm close to the door, I can see the door from here, actually, that I think it's interesting that as I am coming to the end of this securitist path, I find that the one significant piece of business that we are doing is trying to figure out where and when will the end be declared, because then I will decide how many things I'm going to load into the process, how I'm going to front load all of the thing, make everybody really busy, so that at the end, my bill will have to get voted on because of rules of dates by and that sort of thing. This is just plain deciding to not have a legislature, because in the end, all we're deciding is to when are we going to start this securitist process, and then maybe we'll have an end by the time we get to it. I know that I sound energized about it, but I am very curious how the public should be at peace with this effort to kind of never allow the end to happen. Maybe we should just do that, say that we are in continuous session and that we just get voted in and out of that continuous session, but that this artificial ending that we all lay down and submit ourselves to doesn't really exist. I have sat here and watched it be manipulated to every end, and we are not respecting it in any way. Now, I know that in all my previous life, when an end was declared, it was an end. But this is a place which is interesting, that by a majority or by somebody else's statement, we can push the end to an interminable time. And I think we're doing that on purpose, because we're in love with the fight at the end, the adrenaline of that. And we're not really interested in being done talking about something, which is kind of the purpose that the public expects. The public expects us to take up an issue, discuss it, and then vote to be done with it. And then they will go on living their lives within whatever we've passed. We really have started to mess with that. And I can see it coming every year. And I know you can. And I know I'm just loud and noisy about this. And it's apparent that the legislature is yet happy to do that. And I find that, I guess, I'm that's a statement of some protest. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. Seeing no further discussion, then I'll move that the proposed joint rule change be referred to the full rules committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Mr. McCormick, next on the agenda.
Mr. Chair, members, the next is also a change to joint rule 2.06 on conference committees. And you'll see it's on the first page this time in the underlined language. It requires the chair holding the gavel to call a public conference committee meeting every day, weekends and holidays excepted.
Discussion, members. Representative Rumbach.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was actually thinking about this one. We were on this other one. But anyway, so the everyday thing seems to be pretty restrictive. I mean, it's harsh, and it seems like you could end up having a chair call the meeting, set the date, have everything prepared, have a meeting called, and then come and have it be recessed. Right? I mean, I don't think we have found a way around that. So, and you have, at the same time, you've notified a lot of people who are going to come and waste their time. I mean, it just seems like, looking at the downsides here, that this may be a bit harsh and hard to implement, not really satisfactory.
Representative Rumbach, I think you're correct, but the other side of it is this. Unless we have some type of a stepped process, and if you're going to have a drop-dead deadline for our conference committee, then people better focus on what you're going to put in the conference committee. And that takes work. And that means there should be proposals made on a regular basis of what the conference committee is going to contain by the time you end that conference committee. So you have both sides of it. We perfected the one way of not doing it, but I think we have to now take a look at, yes, it's our responsibility to make a conference committee report. Conference committee is blank when we start. So every day there should at least be proposals or discussion of what might go in that conference committee report.
And Representative Rumbach. Mr. Chair, so in this case, you know, if there's a particular emergency affecting a particular committee or chair, whatever, do we think there should be exceptions here or some?
Representative Rumbach, I'm sure there are always exceptions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm maybe not too concerned about, to respond to Representative Runbeck's point about staff and members of the public, that when there's a conference committee that is meeting, of course, really at any time, the chair may end up calling a meeting. And I guess I'm less concerned at that point we've got bills that have been passed by both bodies that are being reconciled. And so I guess it seems to me that I guess I'm less concerned about there being an imposition on staff or members of the public by having a public hearing, because, of course, that is supposed to be the business of the conference committee. So I guess just as you're raising that concern, I guess for me that seems like less of one as compared to the benefit of trying to push forward the process of reconciling the two bills that have been passed. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion, members? Seeing no further discussion, then I'll move that the proposed joint rules change be referred to the full rules committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, members, the next proposed change is a change to rule House Rule 4.03. And the change is right there at the beginning in paragraph B. And I think maybe Chief Fiscal Analyst Mr. Marks should probably come up to respond to some of these questions. But the change limits the number of days that are available to create the targets, the budget resolution, to 14 days, and it's currently 25.
Mr. Marks, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, Bill Marks, Chief Fiscal Analyst. This would take 11 days off the possible length of time to develop the budget resolution here after the forecast. The point I would make on this, the current rule says within 25 days, so it can be done sooner now. The one other note here is that there is sometimes an interest in what the governor's supplemental budget recommendations are after the February forecast, and those supplemental budget recommendations have been this past year. It was March 22nd, and in recent years it's not been any earlier than March 17th. So I think that's the one consideration here is to what extent there's interest in knowing what the governor's supplemental budget recommendations are before the House adopts a budget resolution.
Discussion, members.
Good point.
Representative Murphy?
I thought that was the last thing Mr. Mark said was a good point.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Marks, can you just talk further about kind of what the implications would be to having that period shortened? I mean, I'm just kind of with your experience having done this over quite a long time, what practical implications will we see? I mean, do you have concerns about there being sufficient time for the targets to be generated, et cetera? Like, what can you share with us, drawing on your experience?
Mr. Mark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, the key information we get is the February forecast information, which is typically the end of February. Since the language keys off that forecast, it's that amount of time. This would give 2 weeks. That's, from a technical perspective, that's an adequate amount of time to develop a budget resolution. The other side of it is for the majority party to make their decisions on what the targets should be. Is that an adequate amount of time or not? And that depends on the process that's used and how those decisions are made. So I think it can be done. As I said before, I think the biggest consideration is, does the majority party want to know what the governor's budget recommendations are as they adopt or as they develop those budget recommendations, and then do all the members of the Ways and Means Committee want to know what the governor's supplemental budget recommendations are before they act on a budget resolution?
And Representative Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Marks, remind us of when the governor's supplemental budget recommendations are due. I think there is a due date for them.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, there is no requirement that the governor even submit supplemental budget recommendations. Most governors have been doing that in recent years, but there is no requirement for a governor to do that.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I certainly support keeping the process moving. I guess I wonder a little bit about the assumption behind this proposal. That seems to be that if we shorten the number of days at the beginning of the process, we will relieve pressure at the end of the process. And I wonder, and if that is the assumption, I wonder a little bit about that assumption because I don't know that we're running out of time. It seems like we're running out of time because everything's just getting, because we're not deciding till the very, very end, or the decisions are not being made till the very end, who's the passive voice. So I'm not opposed, but I'm just wondering if, Mr. Marks can comment about some of the advantages of having a shorter time, or Mr. Chair, if you have thoughts on that.
Mr. Marks, you wish to continue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, members, the advantage would be the decision is out there sooner. Now, one other consideration here is the budget resolution can always be amended, so it could be changed after that point in time as well. But I think you're also correct. I don't think the current resolution or the current 25 days removes or limits the amount of time available at the end. There is enough time later, but there are so many other variables in the process that I don't know how. Yes, this would mean the decision has to be made at least 11 days sooner. The other point, and I didn't bring all my statistics, I know that this past year in 2019, the resolution was adopted on Monday, March 25th. The governor's budget supplemental budget recommendations were officially released on Friday, March 22nd. So it was a pretty tight time frame there. In 2017, I believe the budget resolution was adopted on March 22nd, and I don't remember what day that was. And I believe the governor's supplemental budget recommendations were around March 17th or 18th that year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto, I think part of the understanding of this was to focus the work of the legislature in January and February more on budgets and understanding the budgets so that when any type of a decision was made, we would not be focusing on members' bills. We would have an understanding of the accounts that are before our various committees when we then take action, whether it's a bill or a proposal, we'd have a better understanding of it. So that was part of the earlier discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion, member. Seeing none, then I'll move that the proposed House rule change with the calendar days be referred to the full Rules Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Mr. McCormick.
Members, the next change is a change to House by creating a new House rule, House Rule 4.015, policy removed from major finance and revenue bills. We know what a major finance and revenue bill is. They're defined under House Rule 4.03. So this proposed rule states that those bills must not contain policy language that is not directly related to a fiscal decision made in the bill or that has no fiscal impact or a negligible fiscal impact as defined under Rule 4.10. So the question always rises, what do you mean by no fiscal impact? We also have a rule that defines that. If a bill, an omnibus bill, maybe the omnibus agriculture bill, came to the Ways and Committee and it had a whole bunch of policy provisions, the chair of Ways and Means would prepare an amendment reviewing and removing all of the policy that had no fiscal impact or a negligible impact. And that would have to happen. That amendment would have to be prepared before referring these bills to the General Register. Now, the Ways and Means Committee could choose not to adopt that amendment. You can't bind what members may or may not do, but this rule would at least require that the Chair of Ways and Means prepare that amendment, probably for each of the omnibus bills.
Discussion, members. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can Mr. McCormick just direct us to the rule he's referencing that defines fiscal impact? I think I might have it, 4.10 maybe, but I'm not positive.
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, members, that is 4.10, and it is a if you take a look at Rule 4.10, which I think is in your packet, a bill that negligibly affects any present or future financial obligation, budget policy, or revenue of the state is not subject to mandatory referral. That's the first important fact. And then secondly, paragraph D puts the authority of the chairs of the Committee of Taxes and Ways and Means to advise the speaker on how to interpret this rule and may determine whether or not any given piece of legislation must be referred to the committees. In practice, you'll sometimes hear, most recently, Chair Carlson talk about his threshold where a bill that has under $3,000 a year of fiscal impact is deemed to have negligible or no fiscal impact and therefore doesn't have to be referred through the financial committee process. And that threshold is something that is created by the Chair of Ways and Means. The tax chair can create a similar threshold for fees, and whether a fee has to go to the tax committee is something that the chair of the tax committee advises the body on.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little bit troubled by the reference to the rule, or just feel like if this were to move forward, we'd need to flesh it out more, because the phrase negligible impact in the proposed rule, and then there's a definition, and the definition of negligible impact would be negligibly affects any present or future financial obligation, budget policy, or revenue of the state, which seems like it's sort of using the term within it. So I don't know that it necessarily fleshes that out in a real helpful way. We might want, if this moves forward, to be to spell it in a more concrete way, unless I'm missing something. Maybe Mr. McCormick can comment on my understanding of the rule.
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, members, it probably could be refined a little bit at the Rules Committee stop. I think the purpose of citing Rule 4.10 here ties this decision to a decision made by the Chair of Ways and Means. And under current rules, the Chair of Ways and Means already is deciding whether a bill has no fiscal impact or negligible fiscal impact. And under this rule, the Chair of Ways and Means would further prepare an amendment that would apply. So by setting Rule 4.10, we're kind of dovetailing to the same person. But we can certainly take a look at whether the language is circular or confusing and maybe work on this at the next stop.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. So it seems like the way the rule then is constructed, both the proposed rule, both in the language and the proposed rule and the reference to 4.10, it really gives the Chair of Ways and Means then a pretty tremendous amount of power, of which there's a fair amount right now, but it sounds like even more in terms of deciding exactly which provisions would fall under this and which ones would get carved out of those bills. Mr. McCormick can comment on that.
This is an important note about House Research and House Fiscal and the revisor. We'll put anything in a bill that the author of the bill wants. We'll put a palpably unconstitutional provision in a bill. We won't want to put something that violates one of the canons of statutory construction, but sometimes we even do that at the request of an author, because the author is the constitutional officer who's telling us what to do with the bill. So this rule puts another constitutional officer, another person who has an election certificate, in the decision loop. And it's somewhat arbitrary in that you could pick any point in the process. At one point, under Speaker Thiessen, a version of this rule was floated on the House floor, which would require these bills to be re-referred without a vote to the Rules Committee by order of the presiding officer. The Chief Clerk opposed that because the Chief Clerk strenuously believes that all matters must be voted on by the body. But if that rule had been adopted, then the presiding officer would have taken a look at the omnibus bill and said, boy, it looks like a lot of policy to me, and sent it to the Rules Committee. Under this version of the rule, or under the Thiessen version of the rule, an actual vote of the members is necessary to remove the language in the bill. So in this rule, the Chair of Ways and Means prepares an amendment, which in the view of the Chairs and Ways and Means, perhaps consulting with the author, perhaps consulting with the minority, but in the view of that chair, constitutes extraneous policy language. That amendment then is placed before the members of the Ways and Means Committee. They decide.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. McCormick.
Senator Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is very important. I actually have several questions about it, and unfortunately I have a constituent waiting in my office, so I'm just going to lay out my concerns and then have to run. But I agree with Representative Pinto about vesting more of this power in the Chair of the Ways and Means. I think the intent is to stop loading up the omnibus bills with policy, which I think we all share a concern about, those of us who have been participating in this process. And if, as Mr. McCormick indicated, the chair has to propose this amendment, but then it goes to the Ways and Means Committee, it may or may not be voted on. I would like to get to the point where the full House has to vote. I don't know if that's possible, but it seems to me like it's very circular the way we're currently constructing it, even though we're trying to get at it. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us, not just those on Ways and Means, to be held accountable for loading these things up with policy. And I'm sorry, I have to run.
Thank you. Representative Rumbick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a couple of things. I do have concerns, too. I mean, you have an amendment that's basically said much of this bill, you know, should not be part of the bill. And what does that do to someone on the floor trying to re-amend some things or to make amendments then to that omnibus bill? Does that preclude those things, you know, that any attempt on the floor for changing? And then secondly, the term directly related, I mean, you end up having one person, maybe two, you know, who are the persons that will decide what's directly related, which is a, you know, that's pretty much of a judgment call, it seems to me. I mean, there may be some clear cases, but you know, I don't know how we can be clearer about certain policies maybe are just more than the omnibus should contain, but I'm not sure that these do the job very well, and certainly it's all in the hands of a couple people at this point.
Representative Rembeck, members of the committee may be interpreted, too, to refocus the Ways and Means Committee as a fiscal committee and not the Ways and Everything Committee, so that when a bill comes before the committee, it is the role of the committee to articulate whether or not the fiscal part of the bill meets those budget requirements, and that would be the primary focus of the Ways and Means Committee. That would be one way I'd look at it.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I see some value in that. I certainly think, yeah, for a committee of that size to look at 900-page bills and sort the fiscal pieces out of it.
Let's not forget the 1,200 or 1,300-page.
Those two. All right, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'll move that this proposal be referred to the full Rules Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Mr. McCormick, the last one on.
Mr. Chair, members, the last proposed rule change before you is a slightly different version of the rule you just adopted, this one applying to the joint rules. This is more of a plenary approach. There is no enforcement mechanism, but it simply states that major finance and revenue bills must not contain policy provisions not directly related to a fiscal decision made in the bill, and it also prohibits conference committees from including such provisions.
Discussion. Seeing no discussion, perhaps we had the discussion on the last one. So all those in favor of this proposal being referred to the Rules Committee signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Members, that concludes our work for today, unless we have someone who wishes to testify on any of this in the audience. I had no request for testifiers. If they do, they're welcome to come down. Mr. McCormick, thank you, and thank you to your staff. Any discussion by members at this point?
It's been a barrel of fun.
I don't anticipate this is the last meeting of this committee. I would hope that in January we may have a meeting or two yet on related issues to this. So I want to thank the members of the committee and also the members who attended over the four committee meetings and then the two committee meetings that we had in December, too, before session started. So with that, meeting is adjourned.